Gigi Engel is an award-winning COSRT registered and GSRD accredited sex and relationship psychotherapist, educator and author, currently practicing in London, specializing in working with gender, sexuality and relationship diverse, that's the GSRD, clients including LGBTQIA+, kinky and polyamorous communities. Gigi has become a champion for pleasure-based sex education and safer sex practices. Her work and expertise have appeared in major publications such as Cosmopolitan, Marie Claire, Elle, Teen Vogue, and Glamour, reaching millions worldwide. Originally from Chicago, Gigi was named Journalist of the Year at the 2019 Sexual Freedom Awards and has been recognized by the AVN Sexpert of the Year and Expiz Awards. Through advocacy, education, and her clinical work, Gigi is breaking taboos and promoting open, inclusive conversations about pleasure, intimacy, and sexual well-being. You're very, very welcome. Thank you for spending a little bit of time with us today. I have a lot to ask you, so I'm just going to dive straight in, if that's okay.
Of course, let's do it. I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, thank you. The first thing I wanted to really ask a little bit was to take you back a little bit. You've always incredibly accomplished, and I do want to know all about your career, but I just want to understand a bit about your formative years. Do you think the sort of 14, 15-year-old you would recognize who you are today?
I think she'd be impressed because I kind of... when I first started out in this space, I was writing a lot about like my personal sex life as sort of an agony aunt character. So my sort of formative years were kind of very sexually explorative. And there was like a lot of slut shaming and backlash personally for some of my antics, as they might have called them back in the day. I wrote my first book, All the Fucking Mistakes, about... sort of from that perspective of what it was like growing up being sexually adventurous and kind of having that not be received particularly well. So when I got my first job, it was very exciting for me to be able to write about sex. And it was crazy to me that there was an opportunity to get paid to do that. So it was very exciting for me, and it really fit into sort of my general interest in sexuality. And I think the haters would look back and be like, oh, I think we might have been wrong about her.
And where did your obvious comfort levels with sexuality and your own sexual presence, where did they come from?
I had a mother who was very sort of sexually open, not in the sense of like, my parents weren't swingers or anything of that nature, but more like she was one of the naked moms. If your audience like knows what that means, like she basically like she walked around naked a lot. She was very open with her own sexuality. She was very open of talking about pleasure with us. And that kind of set us up as young girls, my sisters and I, to feel more sort of connected to our sexuality and less ashamed of it, I should say. Mm-hmm. While at the same time, she also was sort of giving us some of the messages of growing up with quite a militant Catholic mother and her perspective of like, you know, they don't buy the cow if the milk is free and you should only have sex with people you love. So like, you know, she did her absolute best. She was quite a formidable woman. So I think that set my sisters and I up particularly to feel more connected to our sexuality in a way that a lot of millennials especially did not have as an opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, certainly at school, at college, even at schools today, the sex ed tends to be about it's almost like a fear agenda. So don't get pregnant, don't get an STD, all the sort of the negative side of things. And I talked to my kids are 18 and 15 now. And they said that there's never any talk about pleasure, about enjoyment, or it's always that sort of warning side of things. And do you think that's one of the issues that we have in how we are potentially hesitant to talk about this or more repressed than we could be, that we just don't get a good if our parents aren't naked moms or don't talk about it, you know, where do we learn, I guess, is one of the challenges nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the sex ed that we have, both in America and in the UK, really is focused on the functionality of sexuality. Like, this is how babies are made, and don't get STIs, and be careful of using protection and that kind of thing. But we never really hear anything about the clitoris. We never hear anything about the enjoyment of sex. We never hear anything about how much fun it can be and how it's quite a important part of the human experience. And it's never really given that level of reverence when we're talking about things. Like we teach our kids, you know, how to be a good friend, how to be respectful, how to have all these sort of like life skills, if you will. But there's never really conversations, and it's not really parents' fault because they're not equipped to like have age-appropriate conversations with kids about sexuality and their own bodies and being respectful of others and boundaries and that those kinds of things, which are still really an important part of being a human being.
Mm. And I read recently, and I'm sure that the different reports state different things, but the average age that boys in particular see pornography is 11 or 12 or 13. 13 is probably quite old who's seeing it. But I just wonder what influence you think that has on people's understanding of what sex and relationships are all about. And I don't have anything against pornography. I'm not knocking pornography. I'm just not sure how it translates when you're sort of 11 or 12, you're sort of seeing these very explicit, well, incredibly explicit images and videos mm-hmm. and films, etc. That don't necessarily portray sex in the way that we might experience it day to day. But yeah, I wonder how, if that's your education, what does that, particularly for young boys, what does that lead to?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think there is a lot of nuance when we're talking about pornography, because it's not porn's fault that it's become default sex education, but that doesn't mean it hasn't become default sex education. Because when we're not having these conversations with kids, we're not giving them the tools they need to understand that porn is, you know, actors who are in a scene doing a specific thing for money. And they are basically Olympian level sex doers. So like you get this very warped view of what sexuality looks like in real life, because we're not having age-appropriate conversations with our kids. We're not giving them the literacy they need around media. And so they see these things and they immediately think, oh, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And that's why you see these stats where a huge number of people are being non-consensually choked during first-time sexual encounters, which is very dangerous and has largely to do with the fact that they're seeing this in a lot of this free mainstream online pornography where they're seeing these very aggressive sex acts. And then when we look at things on a more like micro level too, it's like that kind of pornography is done very much from a male lens. It's very penetration focused. There's no foreplay, no conversations, no discussion about boundaries or anything. You just kind of see these very explicit, very hardcore sex acts that do not focus pleasure, are very much about hard penises, and you see these descriptions that are like pounding and smashing and destroying, and you're like, wow, it's incredibly aggressive. And it can really warp people's understanding of what real life sexual encounters are like. And that can be sort of devastating for somebody's sexual maturity.
Mm. It's really interesting. Like I say, that's the sort of, I guess, the mainstream porn. I've talked to a lot of people in the porn industry, but actors, actresses, directors. And I spoke to a lady a few months ago called Inga Winter. And she directs what she calls sort of holistic or feminist porn, I guess you might call it more readily. And it's very, very different. It's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, people are fucking, they're having sex. It's not like soft core, soft lit sort of gender stuff. It's just proper, you know, hardcore sex, but it's very different. It almost, it sounds a bit like, what? Is that really what you want? It has this proper story to it. The production value is very high. The actors are paid properly, they get to decide what they do and don't do, and it's much more conversational. But I think that's a challenge, that you have the sort of almost the fast food porn, the U porn and Pornhub, that sort of stuff, and then you have this other much, much more erotic porn that is much, much more enjoyable to watch. But I think people just bundle porn as mm-hmm. porn's porn.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm a huge advocate for feminist pornography and ethically made pornography. When you look at, like, you know, Winker is an amazing creator, and then you have like Lustry and Erica Lust and all of these amazing feminist pornographers who are making this incredible content that's from a more queer focused, female centered lens that is a much more real, I don't know if realistic is the right word necessarily, but much more inclusive, much more interesting to look at, and much, in my opinion, much better pornography. Yeah. So, but the reality of the situation is that, like, most people, when they're children, especially, not, I shouldn't say children, but adolescents, when they're looking at pornography, they're looking at stuff they're finding on these free sites, because feminist pornography is most of the time behind a paywall.
Yeah.
So the access just isn't the same. And I don't think that people under 18 should be accessing pornography, but the reality is that adolescents are finding this stuff and they're seeing that stuff that's more hardcore and male focused and doesn't have discussions of boundaries and all that good stuff. So yeah, it's definitely going to warp people's perspective on that. Just like it would if you had never learned to drive and nobody told you anything about driving a car and the only access you had was the Fast and the Furious movies. You might think that's how someone drives a car, and that would be like, it sounds ridiculous, but it's
it's a great analogy. It's a really, really clear way of looking at it. And I think one of the things that porn does, I think it plays into the myth that the primary focus of sex is male pleasure. It's all about ejaculating. It's about getting off, you know, and coming, and that's it really. Which I do still think that, even though people might, no, it's not that way anymore. So I do still think there's a bit of society that looks upon women differently if they are experiencing or wanting pleasure from sex. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we've come a long way. But I don't think it's unfair to say that we still have huge issues around female sexuality, and people do not in general want to prioritize that or see that as something valuable. Mm-hmm. And it continues to be an ever pervasive problem. So I think we've come a long way in sort of sexual liberation, and that can't be discounted, but mm-hmm. we have a long way to go. And there definitely still is a primary focus on male pleasure and penises and ejaculation, and very little focus on actual female pleasure and the clitoris and education around how people with vulvas actually do experience orgasms and pleasure.
Yeah. And I think that comes down to our society's definition of sex. If you generally ask somebody what sex is, they think of penetration, penis mm-hmm. and vagina. And, you know, as a man that's sort of getting older, sort of mid-50s, you know, I don't always hold an erection for as long as I want to. And I think, oh my goodness, does that mean I can't have sex? I failed at sex? Or if you have a partner that's going through the menopause, you know, they don't necessarily want to have penetrative sex, does that mean we can't have sex? And I think there'd be a lot to be gained by redefining what sex is. I mean, how much pleasure is there in brushing somebody's hair or giving somebody a sensual massage or holding hands or just looking at somebody, for goodness sake? Mm-hmm. But I do think we've got this hang up about, well, sex is penetration. And if I can't get an erection, if I can't maintain an erection, I'm not having sex. Yeah. I think that's a big mess.
Yeah, it's definitely a pitfall that like a lot of us fall into, because that is sort of the definition of sex for a lot of people. And there's also massive ties with, when it comes to erections, a huge tie into what it means to be a man and what it means to have masculinity. And so basically when we have this massive focus on penetrative sex being the only real valid kind of sex, which we call the sexual hierarchy, where we put like penetrative sex is the most important kind. Mm-hmm. And then we have like kind of oral sex, other stuff. And then masturbation is this like secret dirty thing we do in private. So, which I think we should do away with the hierarchy in general, but like when we're wrapping sex into this tiny little box of being like penetration is the only kind, and if you're not having that, you're a failure and now you're bad at sex. It's setting you up for massive amounts of disappointment, because, you know, like you said about getting older and also the menopause and also like where you are in your life and stress levels and having kids and kind of all these things, getting erections is difficult. Actually, it's quite a complicated neurobiological and physical phenomenon. And if we put all of our focus on that, it's not just women and vulva owners who get screwed by that definition. It's men too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that sort of thing about almost that masculine thing about you must be able to get it up. Can't you get it up? It's such a pejorative term, but I do think that does hold us back a lot from experiencing pleasure. And I know a lot of the sex education you do, well, all of it is about being pleasure based. So what does pleasure based sex education mean in practice?
When we're talking about pleasure based sexuality, we're talking about really focusing more on experiencing and enjoying sexuality rather than, it means a lot of things, but in sort of mm-hmm. in a simple terms, yeah. It means like taking the pressure off of performance-based sexuality. So this idea of like, you have to get a hard on, you have to get it up, you have to have penetration and then you orgasm and then it's over. And then it kind of just leaves so much to be desired when sexuality can be so much more of a inspired and holistic experience for two people who are connecting in this very special way. Mm-hmm. And no matter how serious or casual the relationship is, it's still a moment of intimacy and experience for both people. And when we're focusing more on pleasure and seeing sexuality as being so much more of a journey, and we're not focusing so much on this performative aspect of it and putting so much pressure on orgasms, and instead are looking at it as a more holistic experience where we're enjoying each other, enjoying our bodies and enjoying sensations, sex becomes so much more accessible for people. And it becomes something that is a much more realistic proposition for a lot of us. Because the truth is, penetrative sex is fun, but it's a lot of work and it's kind of tiring. And sometimes we don't want to always go all the way to penetration. Yeah. We want to enjoy each other in different ways. And it's kind of broadening your perspective to include everything that is pleasurable rather than trying to fit sex into this very specific definition.
It's a very important point, I think, because I think a lot of people like say that if in the hierarchy of sex, penetration is sex, and I think for a lot of couples, I'm sure they get into this rut where there's always a move the guy or the girl or the guy or the guy or the girl or girl will sort of make. I don't know, stroke somebody's hair, stroke somebody's back, sort of kiss the neck, whatever. I think, okay, I know where this is going to end up. it's almost if you're the person that's been pursued in that way, or something. I really don't want to have penetrative sex, but how do I actually say I'd love to spend the next hour cuddling and stroking and maybe we can masturbate together or whatever? How do you help people have that conversation? Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course.
Sometimes I come in from work a bit tired, but I think, well, we're gonna have sex. We're going to have penetration, but what I really love to do is this. And then you bottom, I think, oh God, that's what I really like to do as well. But yeah. Neither of you actually have that conversation, even though you might have been together 20 years, 30 years, you just don't have that conversation.
That's one of the most common things, this exact dynamic. You're like, does that make sense? And I'm like, yeah, because that's one of the most common things I see in my therapy room. Okay. Is that there, a lot of couples will stop having sex entirely because they will associate sex with being this very high pressure thing. So they don't want, and they'll stop touching entirely. There will stop being erotic touch. There will stop being kissing. There will stop being handholding because the partner who's being pursued will feel so much pressure that if they allow the handholding, that means it's going to lead to this next thing. And then they're going to get pressured into having sex that they don't want to be having. Mm-hmm. And instead, when we're trying to rebuild sexual connection with couples who have this issue, the first thing I do with couples is I make a sex ban, which is a little tongue in cheek, but it can be really helpful. It's like we're taking penetrative sex off the table for a time while we're trying to rebuild emotional intimacy and sexual connection in a way that doesn't involve this very specific thing. And that can really take the pressure off of people. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to then reignite non-sexual touch in order to build what's called sexual currency. Mm-hmm. And sexual currency is basically like the energy and the erotic connection you have with your partner. And that's often quite lacking when you're coming into a sex therapy room for couples who have desire discrepancy. And so we're taking sex off the table, which means that you can now reintroduce hugging, kissing, all these other things that can start to create your sexual bond and your emotional erotic bond with each other in a way that doesn't feel so pressured, like it has to lead to this other thing.
Yeah.
And we're starting to have these conversations around like what sex looks like to both people, mm-hmm. and figuring out like, what are the sex acts you actually like enjoy doing the most? What are the things that bring you the most pleasure? And starting to open up the conversation between couples to engage with each other empathetically, to have connected conversations, to figure out what it is that might be on someone's sexual menu. And I have an exercise about this in the book, which is like figuring out all of the different things that you might want on your menu and kind of being able to sit down with each other and be like, you know, I would love to connect erotically today, but like maybe I would be up for like mutual masturbation and like a little erotic massage. Like, how does that sound to you? And then you guys can have an open and honest discussion about what that might look like. And it feels much less pressured and everybody's kind of getting what they want out of the experience, which makes sex in general much more desirable for people because they're like, oh, it's not going to be this one specific thing. Mm-hmm. And I like to tell people that like with sex, we often fall into ruts with our partners because we have our kind of go-to things that we do, which is like, you know, we might do a little kissing, a little heavy petting, and then there's penetration, and then we're done with that. And it's kind of the same thing as if you were eating at your favorite restaurant every single night and you were ordering the same thing. It'd be your favorite restaurant in the world. It's your favorite dish. But if you do that every single day, you're going to get extremely bored of it and you're not going to want it anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's about expanding our sexual menus and creating more really expansive ideas around what we consider sexuality and how we're connecting with each other intimately, and taking the pressure off of penetration being the only way that that ignites any kind of spark. Because you'll see when you're creating more bountiful ways of creating erotic intimacy, it suddenly becomes accessible and you're going to want to do it more.
I 100% agree. I do think we get into a, we perhaps meet our partner and we're still having the same sex 20 years ago that we had when we first got together, or maybe less athletic or less often, but we don't. But then during that time, during sort of 20 or 30 years, or even 1 or 2 years, maybe we see something we might want to try, or we hear about something, or we, yeah, but sometimes it's just hard to start that conversation. If you've been in a relationship for so long and as a male, I say to your wife, I really want to sort of explore maybe being submissive to you, or I really want to explore being tied up, or I really want to explore role play or whatever. It's, yeah, how do you, I mean, go back a second. And I think I talked to friends about this, and I think some of the stories that I heard is that people have had something in their mind for, you know, they wanted to be tied up for like, they're thinking about it for sort of 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. And then suddenly they'll be at, I don't know, a dinner or whatever, and they'll just blurt it out. Mm-hmm. I want you to tie me up and spank me. You're like, what? Where's that coming from? Because then you've had 1, 2, 3, 4 years to develop this train of thought, and you're coming at your partner with this, and you expect them to say, oh yeah, that sounds great, I'd love to do that. Well, why on earth would they say, yes, I'd love to do that? How do you almost create a safe space with your partner to have that conversation about something different?
I mean, I think that example you gave me just filled my heart with so much empathy, because I was like, I know what that feeling must be like, where it's built up for so long. But sort of to answer your question, like, if you're going to have a conversation about things you want to do sexually, probably a dinner date's not the best place. You want to first, you want to set up this thing called timing, tone, and turf, which is like from another sex therapist who came up with this idea. But like, it's like, you want to figure out your timing, which is when you're in a safe, non-sexual environment, probably your house with no kids around, being sure that you have that sort of setting set up. And then you want to come to the conversation with the kind of tone that's very empathetic, open, a little bit tentative, and you can bring to your partner, like, I really would love to discuss our sexual life, if that's something that you would be open to discussing, because you also need consent from your partner to have that conversation. And kind of coming to it as in more of like an exploratory way, like, you know, I've been really, really interested in our sex life. It really means so much to me, and I want our sexual connection to be more connected. And, you know, it's not that I don't love the sex we're having, but I would love to try maybe we could try something else. And like, this is the thing I want to try. What do you think about that? And being open to their feedback, asking them if there's anything they want to try, and just really coming to that conversation on both ends of like empathetic and open.
Yeah.
And as far as turf goes, nothing during sex, nothing in the bedroom.
Yes. If you're sort of in the middle of sex and you sort of, I want to try this now. You sort of pull out a bag of chains or something. It's not, not necessarily going to work so well.
If you have a very open and honest communication around sex, and this is not something unusual for you guys, do your thing. But for a lot of people, it's a very vulnerable topic, and we're very afraid of being shut down, and sexual rejection is one of the most difficult things that humans experience.
Yeah, and I guess it's fairly natural, and again, maybe this is a male bias, but to feel quite defensive if your partner sort of says, after you've been together so long, you know, when I sort of sit down and talk about, oh, I want to do this, and, oh, is what I'm doing not good enough? Which is not what they're saying at all, but it's what you're sort of hearing in your mind. And do you, and I know this is an incredibly nuanced question, but I'm going to ask you quite generally, do you find that there's almost a different approach in the LGBTQIA+ communities, that there's more conversation? Or, and is it the tend to be the heteronormative community that is a bit more restricted?
I hate to make generalizations, but I would say yes, because these are a group of people who are trying to figure out their sexuality, and I'd include kink people in there as well. Yeah. It's like people who are trying to figure out their sexuality that does not fit inside of the heteronormative script. Mm-hmm. So when you aren't restricted by sort of societal norms of what sex is supposed to look like, I think there is so much more room for discovery and conversations, because you're kind of navigating uncharted territory together.
Yeah.
And so I think that those conversations, not every queer person or kinky person is going to be amazing at communication, but in general, like, you kind of have to have those conversations. Whereas in heteronormative and heterosexual relationships, there's little to no communication, because everyone's just following this pre-prescribed notion of what sex is.
Yeah. Yeah. I've talked to dominatrix and people in the sort of BDSM community. And one of the big things that I've always been so impressed by is how much dialogue, negotiation, discussion that he's had. And it can sound very, very businesslike, but there's such an eroticism almost in describing what you might like or what you don't want, what your boundaries are, what your hard lines are, what your safe words are, etc. So I think, and whereas in more traditional sex, we just don't have those conversations. We don't talk about different things. Whereas in that, particularly in BDSM, which is really important, you want to have almost a contract of what you will, what you won't do, what you want to explore, what's a maybe, what's a hard no, etc.
I think it can be so useful for people, because to like take those lessons from the BDSM community, this is all also explored in the book, but it's like the idea that discussing sex and having these kinds of boundaries and conversations somehow kills the erotic fire. But actually, like you had said, what it does is it actually sets you up for a much more safe and contained and sexy time. Because when you're talking about kink, especially, it's like we are talking about consensual power exchange. And so in order to, for instance, if you are the submissive partner, in order to really feel like you can let go and trust your dom and let go into that experience to actually enjoy yourself fully, you really have to feel so safe and like your boundaries are going to be so well respected. And I think that all kinds of people having all kinds of sex should really learn from the BDSM community around that having these discussions around negotiation and consent and boundaries is so crucial to having a really fulfilled sexual experience, because it's how we experience safety, which is very important in experiencing pleasure.
Definitely. Do you think there's any validity in the notion that kink or kinky is a misnomer or a redundant word? I'm never sure whether people... Well, I guess one person's kink is somebody else's complete normality, whatever. I'm like, oh, my kink is I like to sort of get dressed up as a furry animal or whatever. It's like, well, we've always done that. Or my kink is that we want to role play, whatever. I don't know whether do people like to be described as kinky or having a kink, or are there any negative connotations to that?
I mean, in general, people who are kinky will happily use that term, and from my experience and in my clinical practice. And in my involvement in the community, that kink is whatever you really want to make it as well. Like it's kind of this huge umbrella term, and it's just to describe anything that's sort of outside of the normative sexual experiences, like anything outside of like penetration, oral sex, masturbation. Mm-hmm. Usually sex toys are more on the vanilla side, but it honestly, again, depends on who you ask. Like one person's French kissing is like the kinkiest thing they've ever done in their life. And I think another thing we can really learn from the kink community as well is just like not yucking other people's yums, and just accepting that people like what they like, and it might not be your thing, and that's okay. Or you might not agree that the thing they're saying is kinky, but just because it's not kinky to you doesn't mean it's not kinky to them. And who are you to say that it can't be?
Yeah, that's a very good link to your upcoming book, Kink Curious. The title is self-descriptive, hopefully. And I just wanted a couple of things. Well, one, can tell us about it, and then secondly, did you learn anything about yourself and your pleasure when you were writing it?
I did learn a lot about myself, in the sense that I have written about kink for a long time.
Yeah.
For a lot of different publications. It's sort of been my niche thing. And like the more I've written about sex, the more interested I've become in more niche fetishes. Like I wrote a thing about giantess fetishes and I wrote a thing about alien dildos. And like, you know, I just got like more and more in the weeds of like interesting fetishes. So as I was writing it, I think I became, at first I was kind of like, what am I going to do with a kink guidebook? Because I feel like I've already written all of these. But as I was sort of mapping it out and sorting out the whole book and figuring out some of the exercises that I would want to put into the book, I think I just became more solid in like my understanding of kink and BDSM, and it really kind of leveled me up as a practitioner. So I'd say that that was the main learning in the experience. And as I was mapping out the book, I also realized it was going to be something very valuable for people. Because at first when I was thinking about formulating it, I wasn't entirely sure it was going to be anything new. And then as I was putting it together, I was like, oh, this is actually going to be really good. So I'm excited.
So what should people expect when they open up the book?
Yeah, so it's for all kinky beginners, but it can also be quite a good refresher, I think, for people who've been practicing or people who are going to be playing with a new partner who might want to start exploring their own kink. So it kind of starts very much like in the self. It's in three separate parts where it starts with sort of what kink is, the psychology behind it. It looks at some more niche fetishes and kinks and sort of why people are into them, all that kind of stuff. The second section, you're going to get into all like the emotional safety for a whole chapter and like how to practice kink in a way that's protecting your mental health. And then the physical safety aspects of it. It doesn't go into like super specific stuff because there's such a wide variety of play, but some of the general stuff for sure and things to keep in mind. And then the last section is all about like aftercare, safe words, boundaries, creating your kink sex menus. And throughout the book, there's a ton of exercises. Every chapter has exercises, journal prompts. There are a lot of agony aunt questions that come from a lot of my readers who are asking specific thematic questions. So it's kind of like everything I know about kink very much wrapped into one. And it's very trauma informed. And it really encourages people from the very beginning levels of like, maybe I'm kinky or maybe I'm not, I don't know, can really start at the very beginning of it and figure out exactly what they want step by step.
Yes, I think there's perhaps nothing sadder in a way than somebody that thinks they're the only person with a particular kink. And I'm sure on the planet, what are we now, 8 billion people? Sure, there's somebody else out there that has the same kink as you. Have you ever come across a kink that you thought, wow, I never thought of that before?
I've definitely come across them, but like I've had patients, I've had people write in all kinds of experiences where I've been like, hey, you know, I haven't heard of that one before. I think I come from a place of real radical empathy, and I'm very non-judgmental, hence why I have these kinds of clients. But I will be like, that's very interesting. I would like to do some research into it. Mm-hmm. And I will research pretty much something that if I've never heard of it, it is pretty niche. So I will put my own horn, but like for real. So I will like do a little research and I will find forums. I will find articles. I will find stats pretty quickly. So there is such an online community for everyone.
And are you finding, and maybe it's almost self-fulfilling because of the sort of person you are and the approach that you take, but are you finding you're getting more people coming to you looking to explore potentially non-monogamous or polyamory in their relationship?
Yeah, because I also focus in non-monogamy and polyamory. And if you kind of look at the Venn diagram of like polyamorous people and kinky people, it's a lot of overlap that's going on here. So I do have a lot of people who are coming in looking to either open up a relationship or explore the possibility of that. I often have people who will come in who are wondering whether or not they might need to get out of their monogamous relationship because they may no longer think that they're a monogamous person and that their relationship orientation is more towards something that's in the more polyamorous sphere. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of navigating these rather difficult interpersonal questions and helping people discover who they are and what they want.
Do you think we are naturally monogamous, or do you think that's more of a societal pressure that we become monogamous?
It's kind of a interesting question. Again, we're nuanced here, but we really don't see a true monogamy kind of emerging until the agricultural revolution in human history. Yeah. So that's when you're going to see more, when you see more of this institution of marriage coming into our sort of history as humans. But humans in general tend to function in more dyadic relationships, in like two people kind of forming, you know, forming family, forming kinship. Yeah. But sexual monogamy is a very, in, from the perspective of history, a rather new phenomenon. So I think that everybody has a their own relationship orientation. In our society and the way that things are structured, most people are going to function very comfortably in monogamy, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. But that doesn't mean that other relationship orientations aren't just as valid. And it's really about figuring out what is best for you, your partners, and what feels most authentic.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think we once we sort of moved away from that sort of nomadic lifestyle, I think there was that desire for perceived security, and there's that belief that, well, security is with a person and then we'll be secure, as opposed to, you know, the saying that it took a village to raise a child originally was because within the village you weren't necessarily sure the parentage of individual children, because they literally had the children, raised them, and they were all part of one big family. And I think it is, yeah, it is much more of a societal pressure. And I do think pressure is the right word. So I think somebody would potentially struggle to get very far in politics or in a very public-facing business if they came out very openly as polyamorous or non-monogamous, whatever. I think that, yeah, I think that sort of religious, pseudo-religious sort of stricture that we have that drives most of our lives still has that as a challenge, I think, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would be interesting to see, if we didn't have these kinds of societal pressures, what people would be more oriented to as far as their relationship structure, if it wasn't so socially prescribed and there wasn't so much pressure. But that would be a beautiful utopia.
It would. Do you find that, and I always wonder, I think, well, I assume it's quite rare that potentially a couple decide at the same time that they want to explore an open relationship or polygamy or whatever, or non-monogamy. And they may do, but it's probably one person slightly driving it more than the other person. So how do you advise or help people to avoid feeling insecure or to mitigate feelings of jealousy? How does that run through the community?
I mean, I think firstly, I would actually disagree that one person is driving the desire to have an open relationship. That absolutely can happen. And sure, that's going to happen a lot. But the truth is, and like the bottom line, is that if both people are not fully on board and interested in doing this, and if one person is doing it to please a partner and is doing it because they feel pressured, it will not work.
It's not going to work.
The relationship will fail.
Yeah.
There is absolutely no way around that. It's there are very few definites in therapy. That is one of them.
Yeah.
So that's kind of one of the first, I guess, one of the first foundational things we would be sorting out, is if one person is more interested in opening the relationship and the other person is, I suspect, and I will get to the bottom of it, is being basically brought along into it.
Yeah.
Then we need to have conversations around the structure of that relationship and its possibility of maintaining under that kind of scrutiny, because if you are feeling pressured to be, just if you're being feeling pressured to be monogamous, if you're in a polyamorous person, it's just not going to work if it's not what you want. And if you feel like you're being pressured into it, it's not going to work. When we're talking about couples, let's say we've got two people who are coming in, though, who are both interested in opening their relationship. And we're trying to think about jealousy, for instance. Jealousy is a natural human emotion, but it's often an indicator that there is something in the relationship that needs attention. It's not necessarily like a sign. It's not a sign that the relationship can't be open or that you can't have these kinds of outside sexual experiences.
Yeah.
Usually when we're talking about jealousy, it's a time for the couple to come together to reconnect and to sort through where that insecurity is coming from and address that within the relationship so that you can feel secure. Because a vital part of exploring polyamory or open relationships is that your relationship has to be like very, very solid. So that's, I think, another thing that people don't understand. They're like, oh, we have a shitty sex life, so we are going to open our relationship now. That is an absolute recipe for disaster. Open relationships really need to be explored where you are in a very solid place. and you feel very connected to your partner and you're very happy with your sex life, but maybe you want to have a broader sex life. You want to have sex with other people. You want to have bigger experiences. But if you guys are not in an exceptionally solid place and you're going to try to open that relationship, your relationship will fail. I can almost guarantee it. It is not going to work out.
It's like it might be apocryphal, when people would desire to have a baby to become closer. So literally nothing's going to push you further apart than a screaming kid in the room next door.
Certified jump scare.
Yeah. It's kind of weird. But when I've talked to people in the polyamorous community, and one of the things they say that's often forgotten in this sort of the thoughts of sex is actually, it can actually be quite complicated. Who do we spend the holidays with? If we have a child, is it our child? Is it, we can have relationships. I want to know about it, don't want to know about it, or tell me, don't tell me, those sort of things. So it's not just, hey, I'm going to have sex with somebody different. It sounds really boring, but it's the logistics.
No, honestly, I always tell people, like, people are interested in opening their relationship, or especially people want to do polyamory, because open relationships usually, where we're talking about like sort of sexual exploration outside of the dyadic partnership, but polyamory is like actual relationships with people. But these kinds of relationships are 99% talking and 1% sex. So if you're not ready to get on board with like lots of communicating, lots of vulnerability, lots and lots of talking, this might not be the best choice for you. It's not this like massive, it's not always this just like massive sexual hedonistic adventure. It definitely can be, but like a lot of it is figuring stuff out together and a lot of talking.
Yeah, I think some people perhaps think of it as a it's just permission to have an affair, but it really it's not that at all, really.
Not even close.
It's very, very different. When you sort of explored it, it sounds like your life has been pretty much focused on helping people explore pleasure and understand sexuality and intimacy. I think intimacy is an underused word. And has your own understanding of intimacy, pleasure, partnership, has that changed throughout the course of your work?
Yes, I would say it has. So I sort of started out my career as, like I had said earlier, like this agony aunt figure, really oversharing about my personal sex life, like really, like really, like looking back, it's kind of cringe, but like also pretty funny. But once I moved into the space of I went to grad school and started mm-hmm. studying sex therapy. I've started to move into a different phase of my career where I'm no longer talking about my personal sex life. Like that's not the focus. I'm much more focused on my clients, and there's a bigger level of responsibility as a therapist, where you have this very special relationship with your client, where you have to create this safe container for their self-exploration, which means that every time I'm online writing an article, doing a reel, whatever it is, talking on a podcast, I have to be very aware of how the things that I'm saying could impact the relationship I have with my clients. So talking about my sex life is now become much more of a boundary for me around that. And like, I obviously can't undo what's been said in the past, and it is what it is. But I think I've moved into a different phase of my career. And I think my new book really reflects that as opposed to my first book, which was a much more like, here's the stories, learn from my antics and learn from my mistakes kind of thing. And this is a much more practical guide from a sex therapist perspective, though I promise it's still funny and fun.
How did you decide which topics to include and which to exclude? Because I'm sure when you start and you're thinking about it, you could have ended up with a 1,000-page book very easily. How did you decide what to leave out?
Oh God, it was a little bit like killing your darlings, which it was really tough. I basically just thought about when I was first starting out in sex therapy, and also when I was kind of starting out on my own kink journey, was like, what were the things that I really wish I had known? Because a lot of this experience, both as a therapist and as a kinky person, has been like figuring shit out as I've gone along. And I really sort of had to collate everything down into these very basic bite-sized things. My first outline was like 10 pages long, and I was like, it shall not do. And so I had to really like cut it down into being like, these are the three sections it should focus on. These are the things to pick out. And I think the hardest part for me, though, is when I was talking about more niche levels of play, I'm interested in so much of these like sort of niche fetishes, like blood play and being interested in balloons and being interested in alien dildos. And I was like, I don't know which of these to pick to highlight because I love all of these so much. So that was a difficult one for me, for sure.
Because people love to read about and learn about things that are just, I hadn't really thought of that. Oh, that's interesting. And whether it's interesting in terms of interesting, I want to try it, or just, wow. I mean, there was a, and just talking about you, talking about balloon play there, there's a program on British TV called 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown. And Catherine Ryan, as a comedian, was on it. And she was saying when she was in Canada sort of growing up, she somehow got involved in this fetish community. And this guy would sort of promise to pay her like $100 if she could push balloons down inside her clothes and find a way to inflate them. And she went through this whole monologue of going to the gas station, figuring out how to get them down, her sort of trousers and things, and inflate them and blow them up, whatever. And it was just, I never really heard about it or thought about it. But then if you Google it for a second, it's like, oh, yeah, a million people are interested in it. And it's
community for everyone.
How it was talked about very openly, but in an amusing way. But it was, yeah, that's something I thought was, yeah, interesting to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. There's something for everyone. And there is, I had said it earlier, but there is an online community for everybody.
Yeah. And we're finding more and more with almost mainstream literature as well now. The sort of romantasy novels, sort of romance, fantasy, cross gender, cross species, all different things, and sort of blood plays, vampires and werewolves, all that sort of stuff, becoming much, much more normalized in terms of you just happily sit on the tube reading the book.
I think there's a lot more understanding with, like, oh shit, like the Dracula books were just blood fetish.
You're like, yeah, oh, so really got this, you got this white, everything's like white and virginal and there's red blood and anything. Mm-hmm. Really, that's not like a sexual thing.
Yeah, no, that it definitely is.
Isn't it? Yeah. So how and I think people obviously feel very comfortable coming to you with very particular questions. How do intersectionalities like gender, sexuality, disability, how do they show up in your therapy practice? And how do you manage the cultural sensitivities around those? That's a big question.
Yeah, I mean, definitely a big question, but I think I don't work with anyone outside of the queer community. So that's kind of my specialty. So those are the people who are coming. But when it comes to sensitivities kind of around those communities, and cultural competence is a great word to describe what you have to think about. Like, this is my community as a queer person and as a kinky person. That's why I think I was most interested in serving this community. But it's also about really coming at this thing with real radical empathy and really hearing where another person's experience is coming from and being very open to being a safe container for wherever they're coming from, completely judgment-free, which can be challenging at times, but yeah. I think it creates such a special relationship and such a space for healing. And a lot of it is education and learning about these kinds of things. Like, I am a queer person and a kinky person, but it doesn't mean that a therapist can't work with these communities if they're willing to educate themselves and learn about them and come at it from a very non-judgmental space.
Yeah, because as a client, you can't expect your therapist to have enjoyed and enjoy every single kink that's ever existed. You know, you might enjoy blood play and balloon play or whatever else, but there might be some things you don't enjoy. So I think, as you say, just being able to be open and you said before, you sort of going away, no, I haven't really explored that. Let me go and explore. And you find out the community, you find out a forum, and you find all those things that can support it.
I mean, if you are working with a sex therapist and it's specifically or a kinky person, it is a good idea to see if the therapist does specialize in kink specifically, because even like therapists, one thing, we get into more niche, you're a sex therapist, and then even more niche than that is somebody who's kink competent, and you want to do your research on their credentials to make sure that they're somebody who isn't going to be pathologizing around kink or medicalizing anything that you're interested in, because it is very important that you are met with your therapist in a very non-judgmental space for you to be able to explore yourself, because otherwise that can just add layers of trauma. Yeah. You don't want to be traumatized by your therapist. And unfortunately, it can happen.
Absolutely. And I think people set themselves up and call themselves a coach or an educator, something that doesn't require accreditation. You can see them or speak to them. And they're very much projecting their beliefs, thoughts, expectations on you. And if you come up and you don't fall within the boundaries of things that they believe to be normal, you're going to go away from that feeling worse about yourself. And you obviously, it's a challenge. And it's a big thing to go and see a therapist, A, and a sex therapist, B, and a kink sex therapist. It's a big thing to sort of commit and share yourself with somebody. So you do want to find somebody that really is going to be the right person for you, I think.
Absolutely. Like, you want to go into a space where you can actually self-explore and feel like you're being met with empathy. To have go into that space and be so vulnerable and then be met with some kind of pathologizing rhetoric is like, it's not going to be very helpful for the old self-actualization.
It feels almost compulsory on podcasts these days to ask about AI. I just wonder what your thoughts were on companion AIs or AI girlfriends or AI boyfriends or AI, you know, kink partners, whatever. I just wondered whether you think that's whether that's a good thing in a society that is becoming lonelier, very sadly, that having that connection is better than no connection at all, or does that almost create a boundary from exploring in the real world?
I think both things, honestly. I think that AI has the potential to be a playground for exploring things that maybe you wouldn't feel comfortable bringing to a partner right away. Let's say like you had a specific interest in blood play, for example, and you wanted to talk to AI about it. You know, you don't have to feel so much pressure because you're not talking to another person. So I can definitely see the benefits. And like, also there's a lot of, I don't know how I feel about it, but there's a lot of like sex therapy AI kind of platforms these days. Yeah. I'm just not certain how I feel about them because it just doesn't, AI can't really be your therapist. They don't have the ability to do that. So I worry about that. And I also do worry about the fact that we are getting lonelier and lonelier and more isolated and more online. And the more we start to rely on AI for that kind of intimacy, it is true that you're less likely to go out into the world to seek that because you have something so reliable sort of at the push of a button, but that is at the sacrifice of real human connection. And I just don't think that can be created with a computer.
No, I think that whole notion of, I think there was a report said that in the US now, the biggest therapist, general therapist, is ChatGPT. There was like 52% of people go to ChatGPT before experience. And I understand, you know, sometimes, you know, therapists aren't available 24/7. Some therapists can be expensive. Health insurance doesn't cover it, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there can be some benefits. But at the moment, all AI is able to do is to give you an answer based on their mass accumulation of data. And they pick out the most reasoned answer that they believe is appropriate without any empathy or knowledge of what it is to be a human.
And often, really as much as this isn't really ChatGPT's fault, to be honest, but it's like they're also pulling from the internet where there is a lot of misinformation and a lot of incorrect stuff. So you're not even, you just can't be sure that the information they're giving you is 100% true.
Absolutely.
And so I think that can create a lot of confusion and possibly complicate problems for people. But you know, it is what it is.
It is. And I, it's very hard when you have such a global entity trying to legislate locally. And in some countries, Italy's brought in legislation and some other countries are, but it means nothing. You put a VPN on your phone and your computer and you're anywhere in the world. You can access anything at any time of day, any day of the week. And that's hard when you're trying to sort of have this sort of general local thing, because no country wants to fall behind. And at the moment, all these huge big AI platforms, they're chasing market share at the moment. They're not interested in money. It's just, how do we get the most market share, get people hooked onto our particular language model, and see where it goes from there. But what trends, if any, do you see emerging in a world of sexual wellness, intimacy, therapy? Are there promising things coming up? If we think AI potentially has some concerns, are there more promising things that are developing?
I mean, I'm seeing a lot of sex toys that are creating interfaces through apps where partners who are not in the same place physically can sort of connect their toys to each other and have experiences. Like if you're on a work trip or you just want to try something new or you're long distance. And I actually think that it's quite fascinating. And you can go into your own private, like fully encrypted chat room. So you can have like your sexy intimacy chats like right there and you don't have to worry about anything sketchy happening.
Yeah.
And I found that to be really quite fascinating and potentially quite fun.
It is fascinating, the thought of your partner's in China or somewhere and you've literally got your smartphone connects to an app, connects to a device that can give pleasure from a long way away. It's it's fascinating. And then a couple of questions to finish, if that's okay. I wonder, what have you been most proud of in your professional life, that is? And if you were at your 80th birthday party and people were giving speeches about how wonderful you were and how amazing your life had been, what would you hope they'd be saying about you?
Well, I think the thing I'm most proud of professionally is my private practice. And obviously my new book, but my private practice is such a, my book is kind of a, in a way, I'm an offshoot of my practice in the sense that I work with kinky clients. But I think building this practice where I am able to work with this very unique, wonderful community that is largely underserved, and that there aren't that many therapists who specialize with kink competency. So I think that that's really where I've felt the most rewarding work has been done. There's really nothing like being on that journey one-on-one with someone. I love doing my writing. I love doing my articles, all of that stuff. But seeing somebody's personal growth and being able to be there for that journey is really special. And then as far as what I hope people would be talking about at my 80th birthday, I hope that they would think that I had a lot of empathy and that I was somebody who showed up for people. That would be my hope.
And then my final question would be, so you've just gone through the process of writing the book. Now you're in the process of, which some people say is harder, the marketing of the book and the sharing of the book. What are the next 3 to 5 years hold for you? What do you think that's going to bring to your life?
I hadn't really thought about that. That's a very interesting question. I don't think anyone's asked me that. I think I'm not trying to project myself that far into the future because I like to really take things one day at a time. And I do have a small child and I'm really trying to stay present and in the moment. But I have a feeling there might be more books in my future, hopefully more talks. And who knows, maybe I'll be on a Netflix special at some point hosting my own kink show. That might be very cool.
Absolutely. I look forward to watching that. Thank you so much for your time. I'll put links into the notes where people can pre-order the book and look out for the book and find out more about you and stuff. But you've been very generous and very warm. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. It's been delightful.